Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast, the week of February 1st through 8th. This week we feature selections from the annual Nostra Aetate Dialogue, which takes place at Fordham University here in New York. The discussion this year featured Archbishop Timothy Dolan, newly installed here in New York, and Arnold Eisen, the Chancellor of Jewish Theological Seminary. Archbishop Dolan's remarks are reprinted in this week's edition of America under the title A Shared Path. We pick up the discussion as Professor Eisen is responding to Archbishop Dolan's remarks and then segue into Archbishop Dolan's general thoughts on the conversation, followed by a question from someone in the audience. We apologize in advance for the quality of the audio at points, but we hope you can make it out.
Isaiah chapter 58, the portion from the prophets that Jews read as we fast on Yom Kippur, the portion that reminds us that God doesn't want only our fast, quote, is your obligation not to deal out your bread to the hungry and bring the poor that are cast out to your house? And the passage ends with the following imperative. When must we do this? The Gemara concludes, we must do this right now. I treasure that word now. That's the key word in the passage, and to me, it's the key word in Catholic-Jewish dialogue. I want to echo as strongly as I possibly can the Archbishop's call for us to dialogue in a way that takes us past dialogue. There are problems in this world, in this society, on the streets outside this building that we had better address, and they will be better addressed if we address them together. I would submit that the good name of faith and religion, Catholic and Jewish and other, is at stake. We need to move from dialogue and argument about the terms of dialogue and obstacles that prevent us from dialogue to a partnership on the issues that we share, the issue, as the Talmudic passage would call it, preventing hell on earth. That's what the Gemara means. That's what the Talmud means when it says that if we don't do this, we face the possibility of Gehinnom. Not Gehinnom in the next world, but hell in this world. We have to make it clear to all that God does love the poor and care about this planet. And the only way to make that clear is not to engage in theological argument that we may or may not win, but by doing good work and caring for another in the planet in the name of our faith, in the name of our God. The key words to bear in mind from this week's portion, which tells the story of the binding of Isaac, are perhaps the three words the text says very quietly but very meaningfully, Vayachu Shnehem Yachdav, and the two of them walked on together. May this be true of Catholics and Jews in the future of relations between our two communities. Thank you very much.
My enthusiastic anticipation of your remarks was certainly fulfilled. Thank you very much for your eloquent testimony. And I don't know if these are questions so much as comments and observations that came to my mind while I was listening to your eloquent remarks. I was very, very moved, first of all, by your expression of need for hope, and that I don't know if you use those exact words, but I couldn't help interpret your description of the nihilism that is indeed the enemy of both of our faiths, to be that call for hope. You're familiar, of course, that that was the topic of Pope Benedict XVI's first encyclical. And I just found in my, I'm going to have to go to a chiropractor, I was nodding so vigorously in agreement, when you spoke about that common threat that all of us have for nihilism, that there's nothing here, that we've lost our focus, we've lost a sense of purpose, a sense of drive. That's nihilism, of course. And I couldn't agree with you more. Religion, of course, whether Judaism or Christianity, is at her best when she presents hope. And that came to mind. I think there again is something common that we can work on to combat the nihilism that you so eloquently describe. Number two, I was very impressed when you spoke of the fact that in the minds of many today, perhaps especially our young people, religion is scandalous. because religion is the problem, not the answer. I could not help but think of last week when I was in the company a number of times with the Patriarch of Constantinople, Bartholomew. And I thought of his moving words, quote, where is it here? Violence in the name of religion is not religion at all, but an abuse of religion. You are so correct in the scandal of religion as being a cause of violence, misunderstanding, division, may indeed be the answer that both you and I, those of us who have a pastoral role in the life of our different faiths, ask about why our young people might be discouraged and might be searching around and leaving the religions of their origin. Thirdly, thank you for your mention of what we Catholics call the theology of negation. Simply put, there's a lot more we don't know about God than what we do know about Him. And you said that so very well. I would propose, and I would hope you might agree, that the only antidote to that, of course, is the virtue of humility. That we are perhaps most religious when we admit that we don't have all the answers. That perhaps our quest for God sometimes leads to more questions than it does answers. That doesn't bother us. Even though for both Jews and Catholics, revelation is at the heart of our religious experience, our belief not only that there is a God, but that He's told us a lot about Himself, we know that at the heart of that revelation is the precise revelation that He hasn't told us most of the stuff about Himself, and that in many areas of life, he leaves us guessing, all right? That's not bad, and the humility that comes from that, from a knowledge that that we don't have all the answers, this theology of negation, as Catholics usually call it, I think brings us to a humility. Bravo on your insistence that maybe it's time, again, not to be embarrassed in dialogue for speaking frankly about what we disagree on. Though the few veterans of ecumenism can remember, in the immediate years following Nostra Aetate, that the byword seems to be, oh, there's so much more on which we agree than that we disagree. So, which is true. But as you know, the unintended corollary of that could be sort of a blasé, least common denominator, as you used it, Arnie, a least common denominator religion that is then emptied of its pizzazz and its unique character. Cardinal Joseph Bernardine, whom you quoted, said, the purpose of dialogue is not to become the other, but to become more genuinely ourselves. And I have found in my dialogue with my Jewish friends, I end up a better Catholic, all right? Because I also find out, because they will tell me, that the best way I can serve them is by being faithful to my Catholic beliefs. So bravo for saying that. Finally, my Lord, did you ever say it well about the whole necessity for daily justice? How moved I was to hear you say that the reading for Yom Kippur is from Isaiah, about the kind of fast that God wants. That, of course, is our reading for Ash Wednesday. All right? So there we have it again. That the real purpose of religious piety and religious devotion is to lead to the interior renewal of consonance with the divine design that would call us to service of others and service of the community. I don't know if I've heard anybody say it as well as you did tonight, Arnie, so thank you very much.
Thank you. One hesitates as a historian, both of us are historians, which is another neat parallel here, that you have an American church historian sitting beside a historian of American Judaism. It's quite interesting that we both ended up where we've ended up, of responsibility for communities of American religious individuals. What I'm worried about is that individualism not only has choice supervening what you call obligation or ontological status, the difficulty is one confronts religion from the outside. One looks at it as a possible option in life, which I'll consider along with so many other options, and religion never gained adherence by being looked at from the outside. Let's not say never. Let's never say never. Let's say rarely. What I'm trying to say is one grows up in a community. One grows up in a faith. One grows up in rituals. One grows up inside stories in which God is a leading character. One says, thank God, and means it, because God is part of one's world. And in that kind of environment, it's not a problem that there's science. It's not a problem that there's arts, because everything can be made to fit together. And one's not forced to ask the question of why all the time. But the minute one asks the question why, and everything becomes a why, and one cannot move an inch without answering the question why to one's satisfaction, it's very difficult to retain loyalty to anything. Now, I think our joint problem is that we need to give people experiences. I say this as an author of books, that books don't do it. Books can only get you so far. What we need to do is give people experiences of religious community in which they see two things happening. Number one, they see themselves moved profoundly. They see that there's a place for themselves in the world they hadn't recognized before, and there's a tradition which enriches them, which ennobles them, which makes them bigger than they could be on their own. And they learn this not by a book, but by feeling it, thinking it, living it as part of a community. Their space and time become sacred. So we have to find ways. This is what we're both talking about, Peter Berger here, that the plausibility structures, these mediating structures, these things that catch an individual up with experiences. But the second thing we have to do is recognize something, that human beings, and especially young people, have an urgent need to do good in the world and to see themselves doing good. So we have to catch them up in acts of justice and kindness, both acts of justice and kindness that are done in our communities by virtue of the faith of those communities, but also acts of justice and kindness that transcend the borders of those faith communities, because they have to know that one can perform a universal service by being a Jewish human being or a Catholic human being, and one does this side by side. Therefore, to link up your call with my call, I think the way to get young people, especially, beyond the excessive individualism of American culture is to show them that communities can matter and enrich the self and make the world better. We can preach it to them all we want to, but I think we're going to have to show them, by doing it, that we help them be agents of change in the world.
So,
observation and a question. One of the things I think might help, and I think what I hear you say is that as a student who does see a consonance between her beliefs and her actions and service to others, how can you make that somewhat more magnetic to others? Even though you appreciate the fact that many students may be arm in arm with you in social service and works of justice, those don't seem to flow from beliefs as they do for you. One of the things I think, and I was going to bring this up as another area in part of my concluding remarks, but I had spoken too long. One of the areas that I think both Jews and Catholics need to recover, which is so strong in both of our faiths, is joy. Joy. Very often, let's face it, people of fervent religion are crabs, all right, and come across frowning all the time and criticizing all the time and arguing all the time. There's nothing that attracts curiosity more than joy and happiness. And the great French Catholic apologist Léon Blois said, joy is the unfailable sign of God's presence, which I think is a sentiment rather common in the Psalms. So maybe one of the things, and I'm not saying you don't show joy. I detected a lot of happiness in your reflection tonight of your own religious beliefs giving rise to your actions. But so believe me, I'm not criticizing you. But I am criticizing sometimes ourselves who often show religion to be a chore and a bore and a burden instead of a liberating source of joy. And once you appear happy, genuinely happy, you're going to attract a lot of people who are going to say, by the way, why are you happy? St. Peter, in one of his epistles that is part of the Christian Testament, would say, always be ready to give the reason for the hope that you have. Now, that's not a bad kind of mission statement. When people see our hope, when people see our joy, as I hope they see in Jews and Christians, they'll say, why do you hope? Why are you happy in the world that we got? And that allows us, of course, to speak about our faith, to witness to our faith. That was, of course, the great charism of Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta. She just radiated a happiness. And dying people would say, why are you smiling and I'm not? Can you give me the secret? And it allowed her to speak of God and love and purpose and hope and joy.
I was speaking later about that, but just picking up on that, we're reading about Isaac this week. Isaac in Hebrew means tug. It comes from the verb to laugh. Because Abraham laughed and Sarah laughed. This man who was almost sacrificed by Abraham at the top of the mountain is a man whose name means laughter.
I like it.
He needed his name. We all need his name.
I like it.
Well, thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine podcast. Again, the Nostra Aetate Dialogues take place every year with Jewish and Catholic leaders and is inspired by the document of Vatican II, Nostra Aetate, about Catholic relations with Jews. I encourage you to look online this week where we have another podcast about Haiti with John Rivera of Catholic Relief Services about that agency's relief efforts. Finally, we have a review of the film An Education by Assistant Editor Kerry Weber. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.